KUT and KUTX listeners, the stream you've connected to is going silent on April 20th. You're likely using an old bookmark, app, or link that's been around a long time. Please visit kut.org/streams. That's kut.org/streams for more information. If you're still hearing this message next time you listen, there's a form at the bottom of that page that you can fill in for help. Our websites, apps, and npr.org are updated, so you can tune in there. Thank you for listening and supporting our stations.
This is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of March. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier. Here's what we got for you this week. Affordability in Austin and how the city council is starting to talk about it.
A lot of really undesirable property that was not very well taken care of is now in high demand.
What Ted Cruz's first and only run for public office might tell us about his new presidential campaign.
There wasn't anybody in the state that thought I had a prayer. I was at 2% in the polls. And the margin of error was 3%.
And the invisible thing that almost all your music has in common.
It's the starting point, the reference pitch, sometimes called concert pitch.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, the 84th legislative session is in full swing at the Texas Capitol. And one thing you can always count on making an appearance is tradition. Like hazing freshman lawmakers the first time they introduce a bill. Or naming days after celebrities so lawmakers can meet them in person. But maybe one of the legislature's most consistent traditions is taking up laws aimed squarely at the capital city of Austin. KUT's Terrence Henry takes a brief look for us at the so-called Austin bashing bills up for consideration this session.
Every session, it's inevitable that some lawmakers will come after Austin. Whether it's the city's heritage tree ordinance or plastic bag ban, there's usually something about being stuck in Austin for 6 months every 2 years that gets under some lawmakers' skin. And this session is no different. On Tuesday, the Austin City Council was briefed on the various bills that had been filed that could impact Austin's way of doing things. At the top of the list, a bill by State Senator Troy Frazier that would deregulate Austin Energy, the city-owned utility.
So that's a very, very big priority for us to stop that particular legislation.
Karen Kennard is with the city's Governmental Relations Office, and she told the council that the bill proposing to deregulate Austin Energy was filed very late in the game. The people behind it, Austin Energy's industrial power customers.
It's our understanding that the Texas Manufacturing Association took this bill to him on behalf of some of our large industrial customers.
Mayor Steve Adler is scheduling a meeting with the senator to talk about the city's concerns over the bill. But wait, there's still more Austin bashing bills to be had. There's also legislation that would overturn the plastic bag ban, and another would overturn the city's source of income ordinance, which prohibits landlords from discriminating against tenants who use Section 8 housing vouchers. Kennard told the city council that the city is engaging the lawmakers behind those as well. Terrence Henry, KUT News.
The number of people able to issue marriage licenses in Texas could soon drop from more than 200 to 1. As KUT's Veronica Saragovia reports, House lawmakers discussed a bill this week that would change how marriage licenses are issued, giving the power only to the Secretary of State.
The bill comes after the Travis County clerk issued a marriage license to a same-sex couple last month, after being ordered to do so by a judge. State Representative Cecil Bell, a Republican from Magnolia, says his bill would take away the ability of the state's 254 county clerks to issue marriage licenses, instead giving that power only to the Secretary of State.
I'm very confident that Texas continues to be a home to social conservatives that believe that marriage should be between one man and one woman, and we should continue to stand up for our system of values.
But Rebecca Robertson with the ACLU of Texas says voters in the state don't have the power to trump the U.S. Constitution.
The federal constitution is the supreme law of the land. The proponents of this bill seem to misunderstand that basic fact.
Next month, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments over whether same-sex marriage restrictions by states are constitutional. A decision is expected before the summer. Veronica Saragovia, KUT News.
I don't know how closely you were paying attention to the candidates for Austin City Council when they were campaigning last year, but almost all of them pledged to do something big about affordability in the city, mainly the skyrocketing cost of housing. So it's not a huge surprise that one of the first committees the council created this year was the so-called Housing and Community Development Committee. It held its first meeting this week, and KUT's Joy Diaz covered the issue. She talked to KUT's Jennifer Staten about it.
So, Joy, we hear a lot about affordable housing, but what does affordable, that word itself, affordable, actually mean?
Well, literally, affordability means that you spend 30% of your income on housing. But when we look at incomes, in the city of Austin, the median family income, according to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, is a little more than $75,000. So think about that, and think about a third of that. And a third of that would be $25,000. But I mean, how many people do you know who can afford to spend $25,000 in rent or mortgage alone? So when you put this question to experts, like the experts at Housing Works, the Housing Works is an affordable housing think tank in Austin, they estimate that in order to meet the demand, Austin needs to create 48,000 units that rent at $500 a month.
$500 a month, Joy. I can't think of any place in Austin that charges $500 a month.
No, you're right. I mean, very few developers are investing in that type of housing. But, you know, Jen, one option has been RV and mobile home parks. I recently reported on the thousands of mobile home units throughout the city, and I learned that there are upward of 20,000 Austinites who live there. But, you know, even those spaces are threatened now. I spent some time this week with Kip Lewis. He's the owner of some of these parks, and this is what he had to say.
You know, as growth takes place in Austin, Texas, you know, properties that once were not as desirable, like the city has made a real emphasis, for example, on the Riverside Corridor. And positive things are happening, which means a lot of really undesirable property that was not very well taken care of is now in high demand.
When I was talking about the threats to these parks, and I shouldn't call it a threat, but I guess another challenge is that for years, the city of Austin didn't really know how to regulate mobile home parks because the rules that apply to homes do not apply to mobile homes. So for years, owners and tenants got away with a lot of things, but not anymore. For the first time, the city of Austin is doing a comprehensive analysis of these properties, and many tenants fear that their parks may be shut down.
So the situation then, we're short about 48,000 units. Some of the existing options sound like they might be disappearing. So how can the affordability crisis, and we're using the word crisis because some experts are saying that it is a crisis. So how can that be solved?
It is a very difficult question. Some of the options that have been thrown out there are rezoning, looking at places that are close to services, close to bus lines, and rezoning those. The other option that has been talked about is repurposing. During the campaign, many of the candidates were talking about properties owned by the city of Austin that could be repurposed for affordable housing purposes. And the other thing, and this is a very interesting one, is preserving the affordable housing units that we already have. I recently interviewed a woman who was telling me about her displacement. She lived on Guadalupe Street, an affordable unit, affordable for her. And she was saying that place was demolished. You know, that was an existing affordable housing unit, but it was demolished. So preserving is a very important one, and also incentivize building. When I was talking to some of the developers, they said, if the numbers don't make sense, meaning if we cannot pay our debts and make some money, then we're not going to do it. So incentivizing developers.
The Housing and Community Development Committee, the Austin City Council, chaired by District 3 Council Member Pio Renteria. And District 3 is, boy, it's kind of in the middle of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, you can call it the epicenter. Gentrification is going on there. Historic homes are being demolished. So, yes, definitely District 3 and Pio Renteria are very aware of the need for affordable housing.
KUT's Joy Diaz covers City of Austin issues for KUT and KUT.org. Joy, thank you for walking us through the situation.
Well, thank you for having me.
Ted Ted Cruz has become quite a prominent figure in Texas politics, I think we can all agree. And now he says he has his ambitions set even higher on the White House. Although anyone following his visits to early nominating states over the past few months was not at all surprised by his announcement this week. But now reporters and the talking heads on TV are scrambling to handicap Cruz's chances of becoming the first Canadian-born politician to win the Republican presidential nomination. But unlike most of the other expected candidates, Cruz doesn't have a lot of campaign experience for people to form those opinions. He rose from relative obscurity to win his 2012 U.S. Senate race. So KUT's Ben Philpott looks at what that race could tell us about Cruz's presidential chances.
The national media, especially political critics of Senator Cruz, have been quick to point out his poor showing in recent state and national polls. He's averaging about 9th place in Iowa. But in case you didn't remember, the Tea Party darling, who is revered by Texas conservative activists, started his 2012 Senate run in a similar position.
You know, when we started this campaign, there wasn't anybody in the state that thought I had a prayer. I was at 2% in the polls, and the margin of error was 3%.
That's Cruz from an interview just days before easily winning the GOP nomination for Senate in 2012. So what can we take from that race and apply to Cruz's first national run? Well, let's start with his successful transition from virtual unknown to conquering hero. Mark Jones is a political scientist at Rice University. He says the difference between 2012 and 2016 is that Cruz is much better known now, so people may have cemented their feelings about him.
So moving them from the negative column or the neutral column into the positive column is going to be a much tougher task than he found in the 2012 Senate race.
Part of Cruz's strategy for overcoming his low poll numbers in Texas was to visit every Republican group that would have him. So expect him to do the same in Iowa. But unlike his 2012 opponent, David Dewhurst, who was a no-show at almost every event, Iowa is not short on political candidates. Again, Mark Jones.
Whereas in Iowa, he's going to see Scott Walker there, Jeb Bush there, Rand Paul there, Rick Perry there, Rick Santorum there, Mike Huckabee there, and others.
Cruz was also heavily outspent in 2012 by Dewhurst, an establishment-backed candidate with a personal fortune that fueled his campaign. But Cruz was able to effectively use the free help provided by grassroots activists. And based on his speech announcing his presidential run on Monday, it's a group of workers he's ready to tap nationally.
If you're ready to join a grassroots army across this nation, I'm going to ask you to break a rule here today and to take out your cell phones and to text the word Constitution to the number 33733.
Mark Jones says that ability to rally and excite activists will be key if Cruz wants to compete.
While he needs money to run a campaign, he does not need nearly as much as his establishment rival. And so while Jeb Bush may need 80 or 90 million to be a viable candidate, Ted Cruz can probably get a similar bang for the buck if he gets 40 million or 50 million.
So now that we have an idea of how Cruz might run his presidential campaign, what needs to happen for him to repeat his surprise ascension in Texas? Jones says if Cruz were able to finish among the top three candidates in Iowa, it would be because he was able to unite social conservatives and movement conservatives into a single voting bloc.
So he would have needed to vanquish Rand Paul and Mike Huckabee, as well as raise some serious concerns about Scott Walker's conservative bona fide.
So a much harder climb than his Senate win. But that brings us back to the final lesson from 2012. Don't underestimate Ted Cruz. Ben Philpott, KUT News.
So pretty much everyone has heard of the war on drugs, right? There's also, of course, the war on terror. And as the presidential election season heats up, we can expect to hear more about another war. For years, some politicians have accused President Obama and the Environmental Protection Agency of waging a war on coal. But as KUT's Mose Bushell reports for State Impact Texas, the reality is a little more complicated.
We're going to start this one in some of the most remote parts of the state. the deserts and mountains of far west Texas.
Big Bend National Park and Big Bend Ranch State Park. They are beautiful.
Marianne Melton is a photographer who's been visiting since the 70s.
There's a freedom. There are no lights. There are no lights. And so on a moonless night, the Milky Way is absolutely stunning.
The daytime views are pretty stunning, too.
You can see 100 miles on a clear day. You're looking over the valley. You're about 1,800 feet high off of the floor of the river, and you can see far into Mexico and mountain ranges far into Mexico.
That's what made a day of shooting last year so painful.
We didn't photograph that day because there was this brown haze that probably went a third of the distance from the valley floor to about a third or more of the way up the mountains.
What Melton calls the floating uck is nothing new. Government types call it regional haze. A lot of it comes from coal power plants far away from Big Bend. State and federal officials have been trying to fight it for years. Most recently, the Environmental Protection Agency stepped in with its own proposal. As you might expect, that queued up some accusations of federal overreach. You probably heard that kind of thing before, like from former Governor Rick Perry's last presidential run.
You're doing nothing more than killing jobs. It is a cemetery for jobs at the EPA.
But to hear the EPA tell it, the agency didn't really have a choice.
So I'm Guy Donaldson. I'm chief of the air planning section in EPA's Region 6 office in Dallas.
Donaldson says the agency was sued by environmental groups to fight the floating uck.
I mean, there's been a lot of challenges along the way on regional haze, but one of the things is when we get a plan in from a state, we are required to take an action. And if we don't, we are challenged and we can be put on a court order deadline, and we are on that here with these regional haze plans.
Regional haze is just one of many things the EPA has proposed rules for over the last few years. The closer you look at the battles over regulation being fought right now, the more you see lawsuits everywhere, like stars in a West Texas night sky.
Litigation has been a big part of this process from the very beginning.
David Spence is a professor of law, politics, and regulation at the University of Texas, Austin. He says the creation of environmental policy follows a familiar pattern.
Of the EPA doing some things and not doing others, and whoever's unhappy with what the EPA is doing or not doing sues to try and force them to do it the way they want.
You can go online and find lists of regulations that the EPA has gone to court over. Regulating greenhouse gases, that was Massachusetts versus EPA. Rules to limit mercury emissions were the result of legal battles going way back. And it's not just environmentalists that sue. It's also businesses and states opposing stricter rules. The legal back and forth is almost like a game of ping pong.
For example, the mercury rule is one of the more controversial rules we're seeing right now.
It was served up by the Clinton administration.
The Bush administration reversed that conclusion and proposed an alternate way of regulating those emissions.
Environmental groups sued. The Bush-era mercury rules were struck down.
And so what the current mercury rule is really the sort of reviving of that original effort by the Clinton administration.
And guess what? The EPA has been sued again over that rule. The Supreme Court just heard arguments from opponents saying the rule will be too costly. So I asked Guy Donaldson with the EPA.
Do you ever feel like a ping pong ball?
You know, we try to focus on what the law requires.
Well, he didn't say no. So what about the companies that stand to lose from these rules?
Limited Corporate Communications, Brad Watson.
Hey, Brad, it's Moe's calling.
Brad Watson is a spokesman for Luminant, which owns coal power plants in Texas. He gave me Luminant's take on the EPA's regional haze proposal. He says it could drive electricity prices up, maybe even shut down some power plants.
This proposed rule, if it became final and effective, cost more than $2 billion for Texas generators. For Luminant, that'd be over $1 billion.
And when the rule is finalized, Luminant and others will decide whether to sue. So I asked Watson about what impact all the litigation has on business. His reply surprised me.
There is an end game, ultimately, and we've seen that with a couple of prominent rules.
Lawsuits seem like a crazy way to regulate the environment, but the rules that result have been pressure tested in court. and are probably not going anywhere, no matter who's in the White House or who controls the EPA. That provides at least some level of certainty.
Any American business likes certainty about the regulatory outlook.
As for the outlook in far west Texas, photographer Marianne Melton went back to Big Bend this year. She says it had just rained and the haze was not so bad. You can find her photographs along with this story at stateimpacttexas.org. Reporting on energy and the environment for State Impact Texas, I'm Mose Bouchel, KUT News.
About 60% of the water we use in Texas comes from aquifers, which are natural underground reservoirs, and they aren't easily replenished. In Hays County, just south of Austin, a question has reached a critical moment. Who has the right to draw from the aquifer there? How much can they draw? And can anyone stop them? For KUT's Texas Standard, Laura Rice explains.
A private company based out of Houston, Electropurification, or EP, plans to pump groundwater from around the city of Wimberley and pipe it to other thirsty communities. EP has contracts to pipe more than 5 million gallons of water a day from this part of the Trinity Aquifer by the year 2036. So what would that mean for others who rely on the same groundwater? They're concerned their own wells will go dry.
What it means... It means I can't use my house. I've got a peach orchard and I have a pecan orchard. It means that those trees are going to die if I can't irrigate them. It's going to be terrible.
Peter Way's ranch is just 3 miles from the EP wells. We spoke at a community meeting filled with people.
My name is Vicki Hysack. I'm the president of the Trinity Edward Springs Protection Association.
Her group formed about 2 months ago, as soon as they knew about the project.
Without Cypress Creek, without Jacob's Well, without Blue Hole, Wimberley is nothing. And so, no, we had to stand up and say no. We filed a lawsuit. Basically, we're trying to get an injunction to stop the drilling, and then the lawyers and the team are going to pretty much question the rule of capture.
That rule's been on the books since 1904, when the Texas Supreme Court ruled landowners can pump as much groundwater as they want without liability. The Texas legislature has left regulation power in the hands of groundwater conservation districts, but no groundwater district claims authority over this area. It's in what EP calls a white zone. Bills filed by State Senator Donna Campbell and Representative Jason Isaac would change that by expanding the closest districts.
These bills will find a solution for protecting the Trinity Aquifer in all of Hays County.
But in Wimberley, Hysack is skeptical.
If a bill even gets passed, which we hope they do, they could be changed, they could be altered, people could grandfather or not.
Which she says doesn't solve a bigger problem.
If we get EP out of this area and they're gone from us, they're just going to go somewhere else and do it again.
We've watched what all has been said out there and kind of like, okay, there's a lot of misinformation going on out there that needs to be addressed.
Electropurification spokesman John Hatch.
And we felt that probably the best thing to answer both the critics and to assuage the fears of the public is, let's get some science, some real scientific data out there so that we can truly see what will now affect, if at all, any of the surrounding area wells.
And what does their data show?
The bottom line is there's a lot more water out there than people thought.
EP says it too has a stake in making sure there's enough water to go around. The company says it'll help pay for a level monitoring network and is working on contracts so that if a neighbor's well does go dry, the company will pay to drill it deeper. For the Texas Standard, I'm Laura Rice.
In Austin, sound complaints have gone up over the last few years, and we've got the map to prove it. KUT reporter Andrew Weber has put together an interactive map where you can search sound complaints in Austin over the last 5 years, and he's here with us to tell us what he found out. Thanks for joining us, Andrew.
Of course.
Tell me, what did you find out by looking at all this data?
So we submitted a public records request to the city, collecting all of the noise complaints from the last 5 years, from 2010 to 2014. And found that the noise complaints had increased. You know, obviously Austin's grown a lot in population since then. and the noise complaints have followed suit.
But how much have they gone up? It was by quite a...
It was over 400%.
So in 2014, there were how many noise complaints?
There were, I believe, 13,100.
And you talked to the police about this, and they had some theories about why the complaints were going up.
Right. They said a lot of the complaints were downtown. A lot of it was construction-related. But most of the time, a lot of the businesses downtown, they serve as venues. So anything that is above 85 decibels is registered as a complaint and a violation. Most complaints came from outside of downtown. So folks having a party and had loud music or TV, that was the biggest complaint from folks in Austin.
Loud music and TV, the most common.
Right, yeah.
You know, I'm curious, the Austin police told you that part of it had to do with population growth, but the population of Austin hasn't grown by 400%
right.
over 5 years.
It has not.
So is it that people are making more noise? People are more willing to report it? Is there more construction downtown? Do we know the answers to these questions?
No, not necessarily, but I mean, from my point of view, it seems like people are getting louder and people are also being more vocal about complaining to police.
How loud does something have to be for me to be able to complain about it?
If something is over 85 decibels and say it's somewhere downtown that is a live music venue, they are not allowed to go above 85 decibels. But say you are at your house and you're having a party, if the music is loud enough to be heard outside the property line, then that is technically in violation of the city's ordinance.
Really? So right at the property line?
Right. So that might explain a lot of these sort of increases in areas outside of downtown and residential areas.
So tell me about this map. I can look at it and I can just zoom in on my neighborhood and see the complaints on it as dots?
Right. So we've got all the dots color-coded from the categories that the city gave us. You can type in your address, you can type in your neighbor's address, you can type in a street, and it'll show all of the noise complaints in the area from 2010 to 2014.
Andrew Weber is a reporter here at KUT. Thanks for your time, Andrew.
Of course, thanks.
You can find Andrew's map on our website, kut.org. And an interesting side note, out of the 33,000 complaints last year, only 1.5% faced a citation, about 515 people, according to the data obtained by Andrew. APD told him that a lot of the time, police get out to the site and find out that the noise complaint isn't enforceable, meaning it's not loud enough to be violating the city ordinance. They call Austin the live music capital of the world, and that's because on most weekends you can hear all kinds of music, from metal to rock to hip-hop and electronic music, dozens of genres. But for the most part, they all have one very basic thing in common. As KUT's Matt Largy explains, that one thing goes back decades, and some people would like to see it change.
Like every good story, this one starts with Jeff Goldblum. So a coworker sent me a link to this YouTube video.
So you two, dig up dinosaurs?
There's this funny laugh that Jeff Goldblum does in Jurassic Park that somebody remixed in this loop. Anyway, there's this one video YouTube recommends to me over on the side there. It's called The Ultimate Test, 440 hertz versus 432 hertz.
There's been a lot of talk lately about 440 hertz versus 432 hertz. And if you haven't seen any of this,
it was new to me.
Basically, the idea is that conventionally in Western music, A is defined by the frequency 440 hertz. And everything else is based around that and based off of that.
If you're a musician, this might sound familiar. A equals 440.
I don't have perfect pitch, so I can't demonstrate for you. Okay, here, it's 440. Beep! Right, yeah, that's not going to work.
Actually, that's not too bad. So this is A. A above middle C, actually. And you might not know it, but it's probably the single most important note there is. It's the basis of virtually every piece of music you'll hear today. And probably every piece of music you've ever heard, with a few exceptions. It's the starting point, the reference pitch, sometimes called concert pitch. It's the note that every other note is based on. Every instrument in Western music, more or less, is tuned to this standard. But let's back up a second. because it was not always this way. A was not always A, or at least not the A that we know.
You know, going back thousands of years when music in the West was mostly a vocal tradition, it didn't matter so much what reference pitch was because a bunch of singers would decide, okay, we're going to start with this and we're all going to agree and it works and off we go.
That's Andrew Dell'Antonio, the beep guy from before.
I teach music history at the Butler School of Music at the University of Texas.
So in the really old days with just voices, we didn't need a reference pitch that everything is tuned to.
Where people start having to have reference points is when you start having musical instruments that have a fixed pitch, and organs are one of the instruments people start with.
They tried to standardize pitches on organs, but they did a terrible job. In fact, you could go from one city to another and find a completely different tuning between organs. And that's the way it was with every instrument and orchestra. Until about 200 years ago, things had reached a breaking point.
As more and more instrumental music became the standard, pitch rose substantially from the later 1700s into the early to mid-1800s.
Higher and higher, chasing what they call brightness.
Now, voices can't do that. And so singers from fairly early on were saying, wait a second, as you tune further up, our voices begin to strain.
They got sick of it, so they decided to do something about it.
And so these singers go to the Parisian Conservatory and they say, look, what we need from you all is to kick these instrumentalists back into their place. You know, to say we can't keep rising and rising in pitch. Let's establish a standard for everybody to go by. And so a standard gets established from the French Conservatory at 435 cycles per second.
Which sounds like this. The French actually pass a law saying A is 435 hertz. Over in England, they had different ideas.
Of course, because the English have to be different. They said, okay, well, French pitch is based on that level of cycles per second being in a cold room at the beginning of the concert. But once you warm up, the pitch rises. So let's establish actually where we really want to be. And that's where they came up then with